a Sunday morning, threw on a t-shirt and some jeans. On the beach, the sun was rising over rough and churning seas. I don't know why the sea is angry, but I'm feeling angry too, all alone, living without you. 10 years from now, I'll still hear you calling my name. I'll remember Paris, walking by the Seine, thinking of all the good times, mostly brings me pain. I know I'll never lay with you again. I poured a second cup of coffee, flopped into my favorite chair. I thought I heard you in the hallway. When I looked, you were not there. Sometimes the silence fills my brain, and I don't know what to do, all alone, living without you. 10 years from now, was hot and sunny when friends and family said goodbye. The preacher talked about your goodness, but all I could think of was your eyes. The way you looked into me, the love behind the blue, all alone and living, all alone and living, all alone and hardly living without you.
Shackles on the rear and jacked up high. Slant six rubbing and ready to fly. Blast back mufflers making a noise. Look out boys, this ain't no toy. Ragtop's down, I got a foot of lead. Strong winds are blowing on past my head. Topped off with the racer's edge. All four wheels got brand new treads. 63 63 63 63. I feel free in my 63. I feel free in my 63. Metal flake paint, not a spot of rust. Ford and Chevy can't eat my dust. Watch my wheels and hear me peel. Burning rubber begins to squeal. They're playing our song on the radio. Tell your mama you gotta go. The title's mine and I got the key. Come on, baby.
take a ride with me. 63. Woo! I feel free in my 63. I feel free in my 63.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
So now that we're getting into really the meat of the 2022 midterm elections, we've had some primaries, we have a bunch of other primaries coming up. We are getting into the farcical cringe stage of many of these candidacies, and we're going to look at a couple of different candidates and ads today. We're going to start with Mehmet Oz. Mehmet Oz is running for Senate. He's running in the Republican primary in Pennsylvania. He's been endorsed by Trump. But as we saw yesterday in some clips from the weekend's rally, many Trumpists aren't thrilled with Mehmet Oz. And one of the reasons that they're not thrilled with Mehmet Oz is that really he has a decade plus of saying stuff about politics that aligns more with the Democratic than the Republican Party. I think Mehmet Oz is completely unqualified. He's done quack doctor stuff on TV for years. He's dishonest, all these different things. But it is also true that at least some of his positions historically have lined up more with the Democratic Party than the Republican Party. This includes his views on guns. Early in the pandemic, he was more aligned with the pro-science side, which was the more left-leaning side, let's be frank. And he's recently had to change a lot of these positions. And he now has a completely, it almost seems satirical ad where he's firing guns. And the thing about this is the first level of cringe would be someone running and in a serious manner having these views about guns and doing these types of videos where they're out on the range firing at clay pigeons and this type of thing. The second layer of cringe is what Oz is doing, which is it doesn't even seem like it's genuine. He's pandering with this stuff, even though it doesn't align with the Mehmet Oz that we've known for a decade. So we're going to look at the ad. And if you're not watching, if you're just listening, I will mention that there's a particular shot where it sort of looks like Oz is shooting and hitting a clay pigeon. These are like these discs that are thrown into the air. But if you look at how it's cut, it's very obvious that they filmed him firing the weapon and then later filmed the clay pigeon exploding. And it's pretty damn obvious that Oz didn't hit the clay pigeon. Not that it matters. It's all absurd. So let's look at the ad and then we'll talk about it.
My father taught me how to handle my first gun. I taught my son Oliver how to do the same. I've been shooting and hunting my whole life. So when people say I won't support guns, they're dead wrong. Boom! Other conservatives know that I'm strong on the Second Amendment. Ted Nugent, Rick Perry, President Trump. But our Second Amendment is not just about hunting. it's about our constitutional right to protect ourselves from intruders or an overly intrusive government. So as your next U.S. senator, I will fight for our constitutional rights.
Yeah. We need the guns to protect ourselves from an overly intrusive government, sort of like one that says there's no right to an abortion and states can ban it. Listen, we have a Second Amendment. We have a Second Amendment, period. I mean, right? I support mandatory gun training, licensing, relicensing, mandatory insurance, eliminating the so-called gun show or boyfriend loophole or whatever they're calling it these days. You got to have a background check for every transaction. We have a Second Amendment, and I support all of that stuff. Oz has had a somewhat similar view to that for most of his public record until recently. And now it's very clear that he'll say whatever the hell he has to in order to try to win a Republican primary. And this is very similar to the Trump abortion thing. Oz pushed gun safety regulations most of his public life. He wrote op-eds. He said we need gun control. We need to, quote, stop gun violence. We need to treat shootings as a public health emergency, which I agree with. And then now all of a sudden he's having to backtrack and find and stake out this new position. Remember, Donald Trump was pro-choice his entire life, right? He was 68 years old and he had been pro-choice his entire public life up until that point. He had no shot at winning the Democratic presidential nomination in 2016. So he ran as a Republican. And he had to stake out a position on abortion that would be palatable to Republicans. So Trump came up with this awakening that he had. He knew, and he knew, people around him knew, you need a story. You need an explanation as to why you were pro-choice for 68 years and now you are suddenly anti-choice. And Trump's story, paraphrased, was he met a kid once. I don't remember if the kid was 12 or 16 at the time. And the kid's mother said to Trump, you know, I thought about getting an abortion and I decided not to. And the awakening Trump had was, wow, I like this kid. This is a good kid. Abortion is bad. And now I'm against abortion for all these religious, all these different reasons that are completely unbelievable. This is kind of a similar thing, which is Oz now has to stake out wildly pro gun position. Now, how is is this helping him? How is the primary and how is the race going? So, on the Republican side, Oz does appear to be winning, although it's within the margin of error. On average, Oz is ahead of the second place candidate, McCormick, by 2.5, and then ahead of the third place candidate, Barnett, by 4 points. Now, it's almost certain that if McCormick or Barnett bowed out, the other one would consolidate a bunch of that support and might be able to defeat Oz. But that's the way it's looking right now. Oz with a slight lead. And then over on the Democratic side, John Fetterman, who is my choice, although his debate performance wasn't very good. Fetterman is my choice in Pennsylvania. He has opened up on an average a 31-point lead over the second place contender, Connor Lamb. So it's almost certainly going to be Fetterman against whoever wins the Republican primary. So that's what's going on there. We'll continue to watch it. And Dr. Oz used to do surgeries on people. That's quite a thing. We continue to explore the overlap between extreme right wingism and mental illness. And this is a link that we can also find on the extremes on the left as well. But it's particularly notable lately on the right. And I have for you today, I'm going to present to you a new character. This is Susan DeLemus. Susan DeLemus is a New Hampshire state representative. She, in the wake of the forthcoming Roe v. Wade decision from the Supreme Court that we learned about last week, protests broke out all over the country. And Representative Susan DeLemus showed up at the New Hampshire State House and started screaming at the top of her lungs, "I'm a murderer. I murdered my own baby." And this is serious and tragic. And it also looks like a Saturday Night Live skit, quite frankly. It's both. It's sad and it's endlessly hysterical in a way. So I'm going to play this for you. She showed up and she started admonishing the pro-choice protesters, calling them murderers and calling herself a murderer. Check this out. So now she's screaming, shame on all of you. But then she turns the anger inward.
Shame on you, killing babies! You're a murderer! You're a murderer! You're a murderer! You're a murderer!
Dear God. So, I mean, it's impossible not to laugh at the absurdity of this. And also, tragically, she seems like a very unwell person. And this is a real challenge we have right now. We have to be sympathetic to severe illness, mental illness, without diagnosing anyone ever. Of course, we never do that. And at the same time, realize that there is political strength behind this nuttery. I'll give you another example. We looked yesterday at this anti-vax stuff where Michael Flynn and some guy named Clay, I believe his name was, were talking about how there are, how do I even explain this? There are particles injected into the body in the COVID vaccine, which then are, which contain Marburg virus, which is a filovirus in the family of Ebola. They inject you with, it's almost like standby particles of the Marburg virus. And then a 5G signal pulsed three times in a minute will activate the particles, which are on standby, and then you will get Marburg virus. That's so crazy. You have to laugh at that. That's absurd. It's just, it's comical. It's a comical conspiracy theory. But also we have to recognize that seems like mental illness, and it's a tough thing to do. I don't know what else can be said, but whatever Susan DeLemus went through or is going through, hopefully she can get the help she needs. I mean, I'm struggling with how to even say this, but a new hero, I guess, of the anti-choice movement. I mean, I'm struggling for the language with which we can really address this properly, but bizarre. And many anti-choicers saying that's the kind of passion we need. And when I see that, I see a very, very sick person. Let me know what you think. You can find me on Twitter at @DPacman. If you have thoughts, don't feel obligated. You don't have to comment on every story. I also want to remind you that Memorial Day, Monday, May 30, Memorial Day, we are doing a one-day membership blowout to officially kick off the primary season. We are the midterm, rather. We will be beyond many primaries by then. We are primarily funded by our audience. We want to do everything. We want to cover the debates. We want to cover rallies. We're going to have someone on the ground at the Trump rally this weekend. All of these different things. All of these different things cost money. And so we depend on your support. If you've been thinking, well, maybe I'll sign up. I don't hate David so much that I wouldn't support him, right? Get on my mailing list at davidpacman.com. And then Monday, Memorial Day, you'll get an email telling you how to sign up at an ungodly discount. One of the primary features, and it really is a feature for them, it's not a bug, of reactionary right wing culture based politics is to create enemies and then to argue that you are going to fight against them and that they are dangerous and that they are a threat to your way of life and that they are a threat to America and all of these different things. And one such enemy for the modern reactionary Republican is the vague idea of communism, communists among our ranks. They might be in the House of Representatives. They might be in the Senate. They might be in your schools teaching your kids things. And I have just a delightful clip for you here. Ron DeSantis, who is the governor of Florida, he's in the middle of a re-election campaign. He's up for re-election in November of 2022. He did an event called Honoring Victims of Communism. Now, I'm the first to tell you that I am not a communist. I am against any kind of authoritarianism. Many And when you say communist regime, some will say they weren't really communist. Many so-called or believed communist regimes in history have been authoritarian, and I'm against authoritarianism no matter what it is wrapped in. And I also recognize that this is a completely bogus event at which Ron DeSantis is virtue signaling, for lack of a better term. And this is just my favorite thing. He talks about the Argentinian Marxist revolutionary leader, Che Guevara, and he pronounces his name Chake Cuevara. He's furious with Chake, but he doesn't even know his name. This is the epitome of everything that is wrong with this right-wing reactionary movement. Let's take a look at it.
You can see at a college campus students flying the hammer and sickle from the old Soviet Union flag. You will see students that will have T-shirts with Chake Guevara.
Chake Guevara.
On the T-shirts, you will see students that will idolize people like Mao Zedong. That to me bespeaks of a tremendous ignorance about what those individuals represented in the.
Now, I am not fans of the. I am not a fan of the people that DeSantis is mentioning here, but. Guys, I mean, an event honoring the victims of communism. This is just another one of these sort of Red Scare anti-communist type rants. Now, the legacy of El Che, as we knew him in Argentina, it's not a legacy that is thrilling to me. Right. I mean, he was a revolutionary guerrilla leader. Wanted to overturn capitalism everywhere by almost whatever means might work. The history of it is that Guevara met the Castro brothers and joined their movement in Cuba to overthrow Batista and ushered in the decades and decades and decades of authoritarian rule by the Castros, and ultimately ended up playing. I'm trying to do this as sort of like as fairly as possible. Controversial roles in various attempted revolutions all over the world, including unsuccessfully in Congo Kinshasa, later in Bolivia. Ultimately, Guevara was captured by CIA assisted Bolivian forces and executed. And Guevara is not a hero to me, but the virtue signaling and reactionary fear-mongering by DeSantis of, you know, high schoolers and college kids who like to wear the Che T-shirt. This is not a major political issue. OK, Florida has some serious problems. Housing affordability crisis in Florida. Median household income in Florida is 34th in the country. Florida ranked 33rd in opportunity. Infrastructure in Florida, extraordinarily problematic. Public education in Florida really leaves something to be desired. If you rank states by their equivalent HDI, what's called the Human Development Index, Florida comes in 33rd. So it's not good. There's all sorts of problems in Florida. And DeSantis is talking about Chake Guevara at a memorial honoring the victims of communism. It's just absurd. And I can only imagine that if DeSantis does end up running for president, challenging, maybe it's going to be challenging Trump. We don't know what it's going to look like in 2024. It's going to be more of the same reactionary fear mongering that you can be absolutely sure of. This story I love because it's really a bunch of different stories. It's a story about the absurd lies of the 2020 election that are still being told by many right-wing media networks. It's also a story about really the futility of the types of corrections that we only ever get. So what am I talking about? Let me explain it to you. There's a right-wing network, OAN. So the way I kind of place them on a spectrum of wacky is you've got Fox News, which is slightly crazier than the Republican Party. You've then got Newsmax, which is crazier than Fox News. And then you've got OAN, which is in a category kind of not really of its own, but it's in a very extreme category along with Real America's Voice and those types of channels. And for months, and really, quite frankly, at this point, it's almost years after the 2020 election, OAN was parroting and repeating and repeating all sorts of lies about the 2020 election, hosting the most unhinged guests to comment on the 2020 election. They have now been forced to settle a defamation suit, and they issued a sort of retraction on air, but it was only 36 seconds long. And we're going to look at it. The Daily Beast reporting, OAN finally admits no widespread voter fraud after settling defamation suit. Georgia election workers were dragged through the mud on OAN by right-wing conspiracy theorists like Rudy Giuliani. Now the network is finally acknowledging there was no fraud. So let's take a look at this clip.
We now provide you with this updated report from Georgia officials. Take a listen.
Georgia officials have concluded that there was no widespread voter fraud by election workers who counted ballots at the State Farm Arena.
But that's not what you told us for a year and a half.
November 2020. The results of this investigation indicate that Ruby Freeman and Wandria Shea Moss did not engage in ballot fraud or criminal misconduct while working at State Farm Arena on election night. A legal matter with this network and the two election workers has been resolved to the mutual satisfaction of the parties through a fair and reasonable settlement.
So there's been a settlement. Understand that that's what they're saying. And clearly this report is part of that settlement. Now, will they go right back to immediately spreading lies? Because as often is the case, when you have such a big lie that you're telling, and the big lie that they're telling is Biden stole the whole thing. It was Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Arizona. They did dumps in the middle of the night, all this different stuff. The issue here is just about the two individuals named Freeman and the other person. So they're kind of like correcting one tiny little slice of the story. And then they can just go right back to fomenting all of the same lies. And the settlement should really be you have to mention this 10 times a day for a year in prime time. And this gets to the issue of corrections and why I make every effort on this show to be accurate. And then when I get something wrong, I will start the next show with it. I do everything I can not to bury the correction because nobody sees the correction. Right. 36 seconds, 12 of which sort of really relate to the settlement after a year and a half of spreading this stuff. It's just not enough. It's kind of like punching someone in the face for 3 weeks in a row. And then on the last day, you quietly say, I'm sorry. And then you walk away and that we're supposed to believe that they've been made whole. And that's essentially what this is. The damage has probably been done irreversibly in the sense that I don't know what the numbers now are. It's probably around 20-30% of America that believes the 2020 election was stolen by Joe Biden and actually won by Donald Trump. This correction on OAN isn't going to trickle down to the cult members. The settlement, it almost should be like a permanent banner that scrolls the screen and says, we lied about 2020. Biden actually won. But even the settlement isn't related to that. It's only think about how narrow the settlement is. It's the two individuals we named weren't involved in funny business in Georgia in 2020. And really, this is a network that is extraordinarily dangerous. And the good news is they seem to kind of be dead in the water. I don't even know that anybody's watching OAN. You might remember famously a couple months ago, AT&T and a couple of other cable carriers said they're going to be dropping OAN. And Trump went nuts and all these people went nuts. But the hope is that OAN ends up shutting down, not because some regulator forces them to, but because everybody stops watching. That's my desire. And we'll see if that happens. We'll have their quote correction up on our Instagram, which you can find at David Pakman Show. We'll take a quick break and be back right after this. It's great to have back on the program today Coleman Hughes, who's a writer, opinion columnist, and host of the podcast Conversations with Coleman. Coleman, it's great to have you on again.
It's great to be on again.
So, okay, let's talk about something that's very much in the news right now. A couple weeks ago, CNN reporter Jim Acosta just kind of showed up and approached Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene on the street and kind of imposed a series of questions to her about her supposedly not remembering things she said in the aftermath of the January 6th riots or in the immediate a period before it. We now are in the midst of people, mostly pro-choice protesters, showing up at the houses of a few Supreme Court justices and protesting at their homes. You also told me about a situation where right-wing activist Candace Owens showed up with a camera crew at the home of a Black Lives Matter person. I kind of want to talk through your thoughts on these techniques, and I have a few thoughts on them, although I don't have a sort of completely defined opinion on them. I guess first, are these things, the three instances I just mentioned, are they different or are they the same in your mind? And how would you approach thinking about them?
Yeah, it's interesting, too. I haven't formulated my opinion on this either. So I guess there's one distinction to make is approaching someone on the street as opposed to knocking on their door. I'm not sure either is really worse than the other, although, you know, one, in a sense, knocking on my door is more of an, not quite an invasion of my privacy, but a sort of questioning of coming closer to my private space. On the other hand, I'm actually more protected behind my front door than I am on the street. And at a basic level, it's sort of no different than a Jehovah's Witness coming and knocking on my front door and asking for some of my attention. I can simply say no, there's nothing illegal about it. It's an annoyance and it's unplanned. And there's something somewhat invasive about it, but I can't say that there's actually anything truly unethical about it. That would be my first pass at an opinion. It's the kind of thing that maybe I will think less of the journalist who opts for this as a plan A. But on the other hand, maybe they've reached out to this person 10 times and the person just won't engage with any media despite being a public figure. So as a last resort, they're sort of trying to catch them off guard.
That last thing is interesting to me because my instinct has generally been, OK, this is not an approach I use. We make all sorts of interview requests and sometimes they're ignored or sometimes they're turned down. And I sort of see that as final, like the person has turned down their opportunity to talk to me.
Right.
But then at the same time, sometimes with public servants or with people in positions that you're appointed for life, you get the feeling as just a citizen that they're in a sense beyond an accountability that it feels like maybe there should be. So, for example, Marjorie Taylor Greene, salary paid by the taxpayer. You know, we'll talk more about that because that could apply to postal workers, too, or, you know, somebody at the DMV. I don't know. So we'll talk about whether that's relevant. And one of 435 legislators, someone who has an impact on policy and law, et cetera. And who can just say, I'm not going to answer questions about what some believe was her dishonesty at this hearing that took place in Georgia. And so is it wrong as a last resort for Jim Acosta to show up there? The Supreme Court justice appointed for life, essentially, I mean, short of some kind of gross, demonstrable misdeed, you there's no recourse for saying we're going to remove a Supreme Court justice. Yes, they can be impeached, but it doesn't happen. So then you show up at the house. I don't know that I'm like 98% of the way to this is not OK. And then the how do you have accountability is where I kind of end up thinking twice.
Right. So you and I are in the same position as people that interview a lot of people, public figures. I don't know how many politicians necessarily, but we're in a position where we want to talk to a lot of people that say no to us. And our audiences want us to talk to a lot of people that say no to us.
True.
And I completely agree with you. Never in a million years would I show up at someone's house. So for instance, I wrote an open letter to Ibram X. Kendi, the author, to have a conversation with me. And I, in fact, you know, raised a GoFundMe. I raised, you know, like over $20,000 for a charity to connect the event to that cause. And he still didn't want to do it. And it's of a piece with his not wanting to talk to any of his critics, which I think is a bad thing. But never in a million years would I show up at this man's house or try to accost him on the street. And I think it's because, well, it's I guess it's no more complicated than the golden rule. Like if someone wanted to talk to me and I didn't want to talk to them and they showed up at my f-ing apartment, I would view that as almost hostile, right? It's like, as you can say that it's just the desire to talk, but it's the desire to talk where they control the pace of everything. They knew they were, they're prepared. I might be in my pajamas for all you know. And it's also close enough to a situation where there's a mob outside my house, where it's going to be very difficult for me to be in a kind of relaxed state to engage with you on equal footing. It's a little bit like shooting downhill. It's like you have the high ground in a battle situation, and I don't want to be really in that position with someone I'm talking to. So there is something really strange and almost hostile about it.
But yeah, I would say not even almost. I mean, I don't know. I was at a restaurant a couple months ago and I told the story, and someone was kind of, I could tell that they recognized me. And then as I was leaving, they approached me and pretty loudly they said, "You Jew imperialist bastard," which didn't even accurately reflect my views on the nuances of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, as you can imagine. But
the nuances of imperialism.
Yeah, that was not... that was not going to, no matter what, that's not going to be a real conversation. And I think maybe part of what you're getting at is, if this is the catalyst to start the conversation, even if it's only supposed to be a conversation, how good of one is it really going to be?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Which is, I think, why I wouldn't do it and probably why you wouldn't do it. But people that are more into sensationalist journalism, and people for whom just getting the 60-second clip of whatever happens is their bread and butter.
Now, what about, though, the people who just show up? They're not journalists, the ones showing up at, like, you know, Kavanaugh's house or whichever justice they're showing up at. They're saying, well, the Supreme Court, where all of these people are here for life, have made a decision, assuming we've been told the truth of the decision that's forthcoming. They're making a decision I don't like. There's really no recourse with these folks. And you could say, well, you've got to make sure at the state level then that abortion stays legal, because there won't be a federal right. And it starts to become a, well, maybe it is OK to show up at their house, although I would never do that. They would argue, what else can we really do?
Yeah. So in one sense, that's actually a feature, not a bug, of American democracy, is that the Supreme Court is supposed to be insulated from that kind of intense public pressure.
Yes.
You know, they are one of the institutions that separate America from a direct democracy by design. They're not supposed to be 100% responsive to public outrage or public reaction. They're supposed to be somewhat insulated from that. So from that point of view, if you think that feature of American democracy is good, then you probably shouldn't show up outside a Supreme Court justice's house. And, you know, yeah, there are, I mean, the point of democracy, I think, is that we have these, I really view democracy not as a system that produces the best policies all the time. I think that's actually too generous. I think what it does better than other systems of government is channel the inevitable outrage of different factions into a nonviolent process, which is, if you can vote, it releases a lot of the steam and anger that humans will always build up about intense issues. And it's like a release valve on that steam, where you can go to the ballot box instead of the battlefield. And it's essentially a civil war prevention mechanism, in my view. And so when I see things inching closer to violence, which is not to say that people who show up outside these folks' houses are violent, but we know how these things can sort of spill over sometimes.
Yep.
I do think it's worth encouraging people to, you know, reminding them that we do live in a democracy. You do have, you know, electoral means of influencing the laws in your state. And that's probably the wiser way to go.
This sort of connects also to the issue of, I mean, the sort of prototypical situation is, a speaker goes to a college campus and they were invited. Often it's by a conservative group on campus, which often is the minority on campus, I will readily admit, or at least on some campuses, it's the minority. And then there are protesters against the speaker. And sometimes they're outside the building, but sometimes they're inside and will rise up as the speech is about to start. And to me, that's not really about free speech per se, in the sense of nobody has a right to speak at a college. So not being invited is not a violation of anything. But at the same time, if you're invited, it seems to me that it's reasonable to expect that you can at least get your thoughts out, and then during question and answer or whatever. But then the counter always is, when I kind of go this direction, Coleman, people saying it's not, if you just stick to the norms, you'll never really get anything done. By definition, activism that has an impact may be inclusive of speech that isn't comfortable or isn't being done exactly when it's allowed. And it gets to the idea of the free speech zone that was generated during George W. Bush's presidency, where, yes, you're allowed to protest, but in this box 100 feet from the venue, for example. How do you think that ties in terms of the speech of the speaker versus the speech of those who say, I don't like this speaker?
Yeah. So the first thing I would say is, I think there's a big difference between protesting inside the event, which drowns out the speech, and protesting outside. At Columbia, I witnessed lots of protests, like robust protests outside, and those are totally, totally valid. And they get the point across. They definitely get the point across that a lot of people object to the speaker. But I would say you don't have the right to just interrupt any event that you want because you hate the person and drown it out. But to your second point, this idea that, you know, you have to play dirty to get things done, right? And the other side is there's bigotry and there's evil and there's all this stuff. So if we play by the rules, if we, you know, we're just going to get whatever. I really disagree with that. I mean, if you look at, for one thing, the most successful protest movement, I would argue, in the history of the country, which was the civil rights movement, they took it very seriously to play by certain norms, because they understood that it was actually strategically important to do so. So, for example, during the March on Washington, which was organized by Bayard Rustin, and the famous 63 March on Washington, where Martin Luther King gave the I Have a Dream speech, Bayard Rustin, at the end of that day, he went to A. Philip Randolph and embraced him and congratulated him on the fact that there was not a single crime at the whole event with thousands and thousands of people. You understand what a difficult thing it is to manage that? Like, BLM had so many protests, and I went to many in New York, where at the beginning, a local BLM leader would say, this is a peaceful protest, right? They would emphasize that with a bullhorn, and still there would always be 5 or 10 people that ended up doing something crazy and starting, right? So it's incredibly difficult to actually police the boundaries within a protest and make sure no one crosses those boundaries, so that you come across principled and persuasive to people that don't already agree with you. I think many protesters, they underestimate the backlash phenomenon, which is when you go too far, when you demonstrate that you're willing to, like, say, you know, like, hit Charles Murray and Alison Stanger when that happened at Oberlin, right, to initiate violence, you lose a lot of good faith among persuadable people that see you as violent and dangerous revolutionaries that should be in charge of nothing, right? And even if a lot of people will only silently form that opinion, I think a lot of modern protest movements fail to recognize that wisdom, which civil rights leaders really understood deeply.
I guess that I'm generally sensitive to that perspective. The counter that I have is that there is a non-insignificant contingent which will frame any protest as violent anyway. Now, that doesn't justify any violence. I'm still against any violence and criminality. But also, even if you say, OK, well, we're not going to do any physical violence, but we will, for example, shut down a road to make our presence more known, because if we just stay on the sidewalk, we're really not even going to have the impact that we think we need. I think the concern is that there are actors who will say whatever is being done other than basically being invisible is wrong and is a form of violence regardless. And then the question becomes, how do you deal with the bad faith criticisms that will come either way?
Yeah, I mean, to me, I think there is, you know, if I were in charge of a protest movement,
sure,
I think that the strategic, wise route is to demonstrate moral seriousness. That is, you know, every protest movement that has really looked back on as something that made major gains for society, whether it be Gandhi in India or the civil rights movement, or the marriage equality movement, it key to their success was that they demonstrated that they were morally serious people that wanted to improve and not simply tear down. And the way to do that, even if you're disobeying the law in the context of civil disobedience, it's like Rosa Parks disobeyed the law. Martin Luther King disobeyed the law. They got arrested dozens and dozens of times. They were, in that sense, they were not, they were not just acquiescing to anything, right? They were willing to disobey laws all the time. But precisely because they were doing that, they took very seriously the aim to demonstrate that they were morally serious people. They were not disobeying the law just to disobey the law. They were disobeying it because they thought it needed to be changed, and they were right. And it's, again, there are so many failed protest movements that get very little accomplished. I think it would be very unwise to not observe the differences between the ones that work and the ones that don't. And that's one of the big ones.
Are there specific, so part of the examples you gave as positively include a sort of assessment by you, partially with the benefit of hindsight now, as to kind of the intentions. And I'm wondering, in terms of tactics, I mean, think sometimes in environmental protests, there's the chaining oneself to X, and sometimes it's a tree, or sometimes it's the fence at a nuclear power plant, or whatever the case may be. Mm-hmm. Does the tactic itself tell you much about the moral concern?
Yeah, I think the tactic tells you a lot about the moral concern. So for instance, if the tactic, this may be too obvious to say, but if the tactic is violent, it automatically delegitimates the moral concern in most people's eyes.
Okay.
Right. It's like if you're even, you know, I guess this is right. So if you're just a terrorist, if you're an environmental terrorist and you shoot somebody, very few people are going to be persuaded.
Right.
Certainly Congress is not going to be persuaded by that kind of a protest. If your tactic is nonviolent, if you spell out exactly what your principles are and why you're violating some law, then that demonstrates a kind of moral seriousness, and that's an actual appeal to the public, right? And moreover, to be willing to suffer on behalf of your principles, like to Martin Luther King was so committed to nonviolence in a way that requires such extreme restraint, right? To literally be beaten, and saying that's the ultimate demonstration of moral seriousness. It's like, I'm so serious about this moral principle and getting it in the right means that I'm willing to subject myself to this. That was extremely persuasive to people.
Absolutely fascinating topic. We've been speaking with Coleman Hughes. You can check out Coleman's podcast, Conversations with Coleman, on which I am a forthcoming guest. Coleman, always great chatting with you. I appreciate your time.
Anytime, David.
Failed former President Donald Trump claims he lost the 4 cell phones that have just been subpoenaed by Letitia James. I know you're going to say, David, how is that possible? How is it possible he would even try to say that? But there have been no consequences for anything. So why wouldn't he try to say that? Look at this report from Business Insider. Donald Trump swears he has lost 4 of the cell phones subpoenaed by New York Attorney General Letitia James. What? Former President Donald Trump swears he can't find 4 personal and business cell phones that New York's attorney general has demanded for her probe of the Trump Organization, according to a new court filing. I am not aware of its current location, and I do not know its current whereabouts, Trump says repeatedly of his most recent business phone, 2 old flip phones, plus a Samsung that he had used until it was taken away from me at some point while I was president. Trump also swears in the filing he has no additional personal business documents to turn over, and he doesn't own nor use a business computer. I also do not use a computer for work-related purposes. That does appear to be true. That's been a thing for a while. There's actually a lot of CEOs that don't use computers personally just to avoid exactly this issue where their computer might be requested for something. The affidavit was included as part of a larger filing. The former president has been fined $10,000 a day since April 26th, when a Manhattan judge, Arthur Engoron, issued a written order holding Trump in contempt of court for failing to comply with the Attorney General Letitia James's subpoenas for documents and records. Trump currently owes more than $100,000 in fines. He has started appealing the contempt order, calling the fine exorbitant and unjustified. Trump was known during his presidency for keeping a cell phone always at the ready for the firing off of incendiary tweets. But in his affidavit, Trump says he lost track of some of these old devices, including the very phones the attorney general believes could contain information pertinent to the inquiry. Trump says he believes the Trump Organization last issued him a business phone in 2015. It's just gone. It disappeared. I am no longer. This must be some kind of typo. I am no longer have the cell phone in my possession, and I am not aware of its current location. As for 2 flip phones and the Samsung he has owned since 2010, those are also lost. I do not know their current location. I took the Samsung with me to the White House, and it was taken from me at some point while I was president. I do not have the Samsung in my possession. I do not know its current whereabouts. Currently, I own 2 personal mobile phones. One is an iPhone he's had for several years, and he did submit that one for a search. So, I mean, listen. Does anyone believe that he lost the 4 phones in question? No. No. But why not lie about it, given that there have been no consequences whatsoever and that you're just trying to run out the clock? It seems as though you would deliberately get rid of the phones. That would be certainly one thing to do. And it may technically be true. I mean, if you go by the letter, he says he is not aware of its current location. That's like if I say I threw out a phone. It would be true that I am not aware of its current location. Is it in a landfill? Was it repurposed? Was it, you know, who the hell knows? It's technically true, but it's not the spirit of the situation. So as we've said before, with almost all of these different things, the strategy is obstruct and delay. The January 6th committee, the New York Attorney General investigation, Southern District, all these different things that are going on. Georgia. Obstruct to the extent that you can and make legal arguments as to why the obstruction should be allowed, and then delay. With January 6th, we know the point of delaying. It is looking, and I have to choose my words carefully, lest anyone in the audience get mad at me. It is looking probable, but it is not guaranteed that Republicans are going to take the House in November and be sworn in to that control in January. If that happens, the January 6th committee is dead in the water. And of course, anybody who has been able to avoid dealing with the January 6th committee, you're good. You're free, essentially. And so that is the purpose there. And with a lot of these other investigations, you know, in one of them, it started to become clear that there was no real interest in charging Trump and investigators quit. We covered that story a few weeks ago. So I don't believe any of it. I don't believe he lost the phones. I mean, if he doesn't know where they are, it's because they've been destroyed, thrown out, whatever. And it's technically accurate. But we know exactly what they're doing. And he will almost certainly get away with it. And we can point fingers and say, well, it's just Merrick Garland's fault. Or it's actually far more complicated than that. There seems to be no genuine willingness to seriously consider charging the president and immediate associates. And that has opened the door for them to do whatever they can at the time to justify not cooperating. That's exactly what Trump is doing now with this 4 lost cell phone thing. So in the midst of so many negative and horrible things happening around the world, I'm going to take just a brief break for something that's admittedly not that important in the grand scheme of things. I mean, listen, we've got Ukraine. We have a shaky economy when it comes to the stock market and inflation, although jobs numbers are good. We have the resurgence of COVID again. I mean, it's happening again. All these different things. I get that what I'm about to tell you is not of utmost importance, but it's nice to have something good going on. The David Pakman Show YouTube channel has achieved and surpassed 1.45 million subscribers, meaning we are now pushing very close to 1.5 million subscribers. Okay. Now, I know Mr. Beast, XQC, Pokimane, you know, these are major streamers that make our numbers look small, but we're not in their space. Okay. We're in the independent left media political space. And 1.5 million subscribers in that space is actually a really big deal. You've got the Young Turks, our friends at the Young Turks, with over 5 million subscribers. Incredible achievement. They're a dramatically larger organization than us. At one point, I think they had close to 100 employees. I don't know where they are right now, but orders of magnitude different size organization than the David Pakman Show. We're tiny in comparison. And yet we are riding up to being only the second show in the left media space to hit the milestone of 1.5 million. It's the Young Turks. And then in theory, it could be us if we get there. We're not putting anybody down, right? I mean, if you just look around, you look at other people in our space, you've got a bunch that are over 1 million. You've got some just under, some closer to 500,000. Right now, there is one major left YouTube show over 1.5 million, and that's the Young Turks. If and when we get there, we would be the second. So this is hugely exciting. And based on recent growth, we're sort of on target to hit 1.5 million about a month before the midterms. It'd be right in the first half of October is the way it's looking right now. However, it's not impossible that we could do it way more quickly. Right now, we're about 45,000 YouTube subscribers away from 1 million. If we wanted to hit that milestone by the summer equinox, June 21, we would need about 1,000 subscribers a day. We've done that at other times. Usually it's like right before a presidential election, but it's not inconceivable that we could do that. Even just to hit by September 1st, that shaves about 40 days off. We only need about 400 subscribers a day. That's very, very doable. It's only slightly faster than we're tracking right now. It is wild to look at old numbers and to see how far we've come. The David Pakman Show launched on YouTube in 2009, thanks to Cenk Uygur. Many people don't know this story, but in 08, I met Cenk at a talk radio conference because at the time, talk radio was still big. Doing YouTube was the weird thing. And I met Cenk and he said, I told him what I was doing. At the time, we were doing a podcast and a radio show. And he said, I would figure out just film, figure out how to film and see what happens. And it took us 5 years to get our first 100,000 subscribers. It took 5 full years just to get to that first milestone. And then the next 100,000 took only 1 year and 5 months. And then the next 100,000 was even quicker. And it's crazy that now we might be able to add 45,000 subscribers in just a couple of months and hit this insane milestone of 1.5 million subscribers. So I can't thank you enough, everybody. If you're in that 1.45 million right now, thank you. And I'm coming to you for help and ideas. First, make sure that you're subscribed. And second, if you have ideas of how else we might be able to accelerate the milestone, write in and let us know. info@davidpakman.com. I'm always up for doing something extra, something exciting. And people said at 1 million, I should bleach my hair blonde, but we never got it in place. It was like, we were at like 990 when someone suggested it. I don't know that anybody really cares about that. I would be up for that and I would be up for filming it if it was interesting. We'd have to put a challenge on it, right? Like if we make it to the 1.5 million by August 1st or something like that. But I'm up for whatever people want to write in. info@davidpakman.com. So let me know your ideas. We'll get something in place and very, very exciting stuff. Not the most important thing in the world. I understand. But with so many negative things going on, it's nice to have something positive going on. We have a voicemail number. That number is 2192-DAVID-P. This is kind of a funny voicemail. I got my radical Trumpists confused on, yesterday, we were talking about people associated with Trumpism who were running in 2022, and I got my Trumpists confused. Listen to this.
Hi, David. Just watching your show, and I wanted to make a small correction. J.R. Majewski isn't from Michigan. He's from Ohio's 9th Congressional District, and the other guy that you interviewed from Michigan was John Gibbs. I'm sure they all just kind of run together after a while.
But yeah.
Just wanted to let you know. Thank you. Bye.
Yeah, that's actually exactly what happened. I was kind of just going from memory about various Trumpists we've interviewed and spoken to and whatever. I got the states wrong, so I apologize. They're all still radical nuts, but I did get the states wrong. And for that, I apologize, because we want accuracy and precision both on this program. We have a great bonus show for you today. We are going to talk about what's happening in the elections in the Philippines. It is absolutely fascinating, and I think it will be of interest to many in our audience. We are going to talk about the new Biden administration proposal to cap the cost of the internet for low-income Americans, of internet service, to be clear. And it seems natural that we would do this, and yet there are many people that are completely furious about it. So we're going to talk about that. And we are also going to talk more about abortion rights activists demonstrating outside the homes of Supreme Court justices. We have some opinions about whether that's OK to do or not. We are going to get more opinions about that. Producer Pat will join me. We're going to talk about ambush journalism, protesting at people's houses, all these types of things. And there really are very different views about if and when, if ever, and when these tactics are OK to use. All of those stories and more are on today's bonus show. We do a bonus show every day for our members. You can sign up and become a member at joinpacman.com. And you can use the coupon code Obamna to become a member. That's O-B-A-M-N-A. And just remember, Alex Jones hates the bonus show.
Oh, the bonus show where you want to make money, but everybody else that makes money to fund themselves is bad.
So just as long as you're comfortable supporting something Alex Jones hates, sign up at joinpacman.com.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
RCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1940.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz. RCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a once and more.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
WRCT, the in sound from way out.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily...
From New York, this is Democracy Now! In the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces have shot and killed Shireen Abu Akleh, a veteran Palestinian-American journalist working for Al Jazeera, as she covered an Israeli army raid on the Jenin refugee camp early this morning. This according to the Palestinian Health Ministry and Al Jazeera. We'll speak with one of her Palestinian-American colleagues. Then to the Philippines, where Ferdinand Marcos Jr., the only son of the late Filipino dictator Ferdinand Marcos, appears to have won a landslide victory in Monday presidential election. We'll go to Manila to speak with the Nobel Peace Prize winning journalist Maria Ressa about the role of disinformation in the presidential campaign. And we'll talk to workers who were fired during the wave of union organizing at Amazon and Starbucks and are now fighting to get their jobs back. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank shot and killed Shireen Abu Akleh, a veteran Palestinian-American journalist working for Al Jazeera, as she covered an Israeli army raid on the Jenin refugee camp early this morning. This according to the Palestinian Health Ministry and Al Jazeera. A warning to our viewers and listeners, the video footage is graphic. The video released by Al Jazeera shows the moments after Abu Akleh was shot in the face.
So what's going to happen under...
A spokesperson for the Israeli army told a military radio station Abu Akleh was likely killed by Palestinian fire, though he offered no evidence. Al Jazeera's Jerusalem bureau chief was Abu Akleh. He said she was targeted by direct shot from an Israeli sniper. A second Palestinian journalist, Ali Al-Samoudi, was hospitalized in stable condition after he was shot in the back. Speaking from a hospital in Jenin, Al-Samoudi said he was among four journalists pinned down by Israeli snipers.
The occupation is murderous and criminal. They shot us for no reason. We, a group of journalists, were there wearing our full press uniforms, in addition to the helmets with the word press written on them in large letters, as big as the whole world. We were obvious.
In a statement, Al Jazeera said it holds the Israeli government and its troops responsible for the killing, condemning it as a, quote, heinous crime which intends to only prevent the media from conducting their duty, unquote. The U.S. ambassador to Israel called for an investigation, tweeting he was, quote, very sad to learn of the death of an American and Palestinian journalist, Shireen Abu Akleh, unquote. We will go to a close friend of Shireen after headlines. The House of Representatives have overwhelmingly approved $40 billion in new military and economic assistance to Ukraine. The measure passed on a vote of 368 to 57 with the support of the entire Democratic caucus. The aid package now heads to the Senate, where it also has broad bipartisan support. And President Biden has pledged to sign the bill later this week. It's by far the largest foreign aid bill to move through Congress in at least